Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Hey, you guys have a special treat tonight. I sat down with my good friend Hal Lindes from Dire Straits, and we discussed a myriad of things about music, and I wanted to see how he did get his start with guitar, but actually he started with piano.
Brian wants to know how I started on guitar. Wow, that's such a great question. I started on piano, actually. But I didn't want to. I always wanted to do guitar. I had a real thing about guitar, even since I was a kid. I remember every time I saw a guitar, like if you saw it in a store or in a window of a shop or something, you see a guitar, you were just like mesmerized. It was like, it just had this power, which to this day, I don't understand because, you know, it's just like a bit of steel and a bit of wood, but it seems to like connotate and embody like all the iconic American things, like the amazing car designs of the 50s and 60s, you know, like it's like a Corvette Stingray and stuff. And it seemed to kind of sexual thing of the pinup girl. And it was an escape. It was your ticket. You know, it was the thing that would like make you stand out from everybody else kind of thing. And it just had this massive power. And I wanted to play, but my dad was like really stern. And he was like, you know, if you want to do music, you have to learn on a proper instrument. So apparently guitar isn't a proper instrument. Actually, you know, it's funny because he would never admit to it, but we had a piano in the house and he would quietly go off and play. And he was actually a really good player, but it was never something that was discussed. And we didn't really seem to have any musicians in the family except like one, like great grandfather or something. Apparently was a stockbroker back in the day, but his heart was, he wanted to be a musician, but he wasn't allowed to be. And I kind of think my father was a little bit like that too. You know, he would go off. He was very passionate about music and stuff. They were in that generation. They had to be very sort of pragmatic. You know, they had to put food on the table. They had to put a roof over your head. So they started me on piano and they plopped some sheet music in front of me. And I'm thinking, you know, what are you supposed to do with that kind of thing? And to this day, whenever I have to read off a page, I become one of the world's worst and uninspired musicians because you become like you're reinterpreting something as opposed to channeling your inner soul. Even though I was born in Monterey, we moved to the outskirts of D.C. We're in a small suburban town called Kensington, funny enough, which is named after Kensington in London, which is where I ended up, ironically, many years later. But there was a little local music store. There was one guy called Art Kalivas who ran the store, and he was my piano teacher. And so I suffered on with this thing, but I kept badgering my parents on the guitar. You know what kids are like, can I have a guitar, dad, please, please, can I have a guitar, dad, can I have a guitar, please, please, dad. And we went away on vacation for the summers, which we used to do, and a family friend played guitar, and she actually taught me some stuff. You know, I was totally hooked, and finally my parents had to relent, and they, you know, they saved up their Green Shield stamps and they went out and bought me like the cheapest acoustic that you could buy with Green Shield stamps. Father again said, well, you know, if you're going to do this, you have to learn properly, you have to take lessons. So as it turned out, the dude that taught piano was also the guitar teacher in Kensington Music. I segued from one week coming in to do my piano lesson to the next week I came in to do the guitar thing. Sort of halfway through the lesson, he looked at me and he goes, why are you giving up piano? Because you'll never make it as a guitarist. You know that. You know, once I discovered guitar, I was off and running. And you know, this was like your elementary, junior high school years. And there was a band to be had every 5 minutes. And so, you know, you knocked around with a bunch of bands. And then all of a sudden, I joined this band. When I was 16, I called Sudden Rush, and they're 4 years older than me. And that band actually became quite serious. It was a really good band. And we became quite a busy local band. And then as soon as I graduated, again, my father, I'm painting a bad picture. My father was an awesome guy, and you know, I love him dearly. But you know, his thing was like, you know, what college are you going to go to? And I'm like, well, dad, I'm a musician. I'm gonna do music. And he just looked at me and he went, what college are you gonna go to? like one of those conversations you would never win. So I had to like pick. So I picked like the easiest college to get into, and it was the local one, University of Maryland. So I did a full schedule there. But that summer before we started, we got the house gig in this club in Georgetown, which, you know, in those days, there was a big club scene. Well, I mean, I'm sure there were club scenes everywhere across America. So we became the house band. We were doing 6 nights a week, you know, 6 hours for 4 nights and 7 hours for 2 nights. And then I was like doing a full schedule at University of Maryland as well. And you know what? Playing in a club till 2 in the morning doesn't mean you get home by 3. I mean, a lot of times it's like you end up somewhere, and then from wherever you ended up, you're running to catch your first class at the university. So you were like burning both ends completely. And eventually in the spring term, I ended up getting mono, and my body just said, yeah, enough. We can't do it this way. So I ended up getting really sick. So I had 2 months of convalescing. And it was at that point where my parents finally realized, yeah, he's not going to give this up, and he's going to end up killing himself. So they actually, for the first time ever, let me be and let me drop university and pursue the whole music thing. And just to like fast forward to like 10 years later, whatever it was, and our Straits, and we're playing in Australia, and we're absolutely massive in Australia. And we based ourselves in Sydney for some of the gigs, and we would fly via private jet to wherever, like if you're in Canberra or something, you would like get on a private flight to Canberra, do the gig. And we did this killer gig in Canberra. And then we're back on the plane, and I'm sitting next to the keyboard player, Alan Clark. And I'm looking out the window and I'm reflecting. And I suddenly started thinking, like, yeah, man, I actually turned around to him and said, man, I kind of regret dropping out of university, you know. And he looked at me and he looked around the private jet. And he looked at me again. And he said, why?
I love that. That is really a check for reality, being on a plane with Dire Straits and wondering if I should have finished college to have a better life. Now he told me this interesting story of how he was in a punk band, but got hooked up with Dire Straits.
DC was like a killer scene in those days. I mean, we had Roy Buchanan, who used to come in the club. He used to play the club a few years before we did, and then he would come in every now and again, and I would, you know, as a tenacious little 18-year-old, I would drag him in the cellar and get him to try to show me some licks and stuff. And he would, like, show me something that was blazingly fast and ridiculous. And I was, whoa, 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 show me that again. And he would look me in the eye and he'd say, you know, if you really want to learn it, you're going to learn it from the way I just showed it to you. Which, you know, to this day, I don't think I can still do any of those licks. But yeah, and he would get up and jam. And then we had Danny Gatton there. And I mean, there was a ton of major players came out of DC. But I kind of felt, you know, by the time I hit 21, I kind of felt, yeah, I've gone as far as I was going to go. And I either had to go to New York or LA or London. And London at that time was a center for music and iconic, you know, like all the great stuff that I loved was coming out of London. So I thought, yeah, I want to go to London like you do at that age with no visa, no nothing. Somehow, you know, I don't know how I did it, but I think I bought it. Yeah, well, obviously I did. I bought a plane ticket and booked a hotel. And no one really believed that I was going to do this. You know, we did our last gig at a place called JJ's, which was a happening club in Virginia. You know, we left on a big splash there. And a bunch of the kids that would follow us turned up to the airport. It was Dulles Airport to see me off. And in those days, you could like walk straight up to the shuttle. Dulles has these shuttles that go up and down that take you to the aircraft from the terminal. They have these doors that kind of resemble elevator doors, and they close like an elevator door kind of. So I remember this image of me going into that shuttle thing and the door slowly closing and all my friends kind of like squishing in to try to fit between the opening of the closing of the doors to wave me off kind of thing. So as the doors were slowly closing, more and more people were jamming together to wave me off. And it's like this image that I've kept forever in my head. In those days, You had a magazine called The Melody Maker, which had this incredible want ad section in the back of it, where major bands would advertise for players. So it was dead easy to get a gig. I mean, I got there, and within weeks, I was in a band right away. You just turn up. And I mean, you know, being like an American, being tall and, you know, having that kind of confidence and swagger really helped a lot. You know, everybody wanted to have a yank in the band at that point. So, you know, I joined one band, that band turned into another band, and then that band turned into another band. And then I joined this band called Slack Alice, which was like a boogie band, and they were signed to Phonogram. So we were doing the university, college university circuit. It was kind of on its tail end. And one time we did this spring ball for this university in London, big university. It was just off Kessing High Street. And they had like four or five bands booked and in different rooms. And in one room, there was this loud band that like was so rough sounding. And there was nobody in that room. There was like three people in that room. And that was the Sex Pistols. Yeah, so we looked at that, and you know, they've got their like spiky hair, and they got their like super tight jeans and stuff. We've got our long hair and our flares. Kind of, it's time for a makeover. Immediately, like all the flares got pulled in, the hair got cut, and we sped up our sets, which is, you know, what everybody in London was doing at that time. You know, everybody, because you know, you couldn't get the attention of any label if you were doing old stuff. You had to be doing like that Fast with Attitude stuff and being spat upon. We got a deal with a really cool label called Charisma Records, which I'm sure you know about. Great label. They had Peter Gabriel, Genesis, and then they had a lot of really eclectic people like Viv Stanchel, Monty Python, Van de Graaff Generator, like really cool undergroundy. So yeah, so we did an album for them and did some touring, and then the band kind of started fizzling. And so I started doing my own demos, and then a friend of mine who worked at Air Studios put me in touch with the publisher, and that publisher also published Al Cooper, who had relocated to be based in London at that time. And he flipped over the stuff and he wanted to produce me. We started going into Basing Street Studios and started cutting stuff. And we had this ridiculous band. We had Herbie Flowers. Herbie Flowers in those days, he was the most iconic bass player. You know, he did the bass on Walk on the Wild Side and a lot of major records. And he played stand-up, he played electric, he played fretless, he played tuba. But phenomenal guy. And you would have heard a lot of his playing. He was all over that Lou Reed album, Transformer. Yeah, Brad Bradbury, who's the drummer from a band called The Specials, who has always been like a major favorite drummer of mine. And then we had Al on keyboards. We had me on guitar. And we were starting to cut when the call came in. Mark's brother has left the band. Do I want to come have a play with them? What happened was, in the band that I was, Darling was the band that was signed to Charisma, and person of that management team had then left to go to work with Ed Bicknell at Damage Management, who managed Dire Straits. So basically she called me all excited going, David just left, and you would be like so amazing for this band. Do you want to go for a play? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? They had two albums out. They're working on finishing off their third album, Making Movies. And in those days, which you may or may not recall, basically, you were given three albums to really break it. You could buy your third album, you were dropped by the label. They had a very highly successful first album. The second album, although it's one of my favorite albums, I think it's brilliant. But, you know, coming off the heat of the first album, it wasn't perceived as that successful. So this third album was really crucial for the band. They were rehearsing like on completely the opposite side of town. I was living in a place called St. John's Wood, which is North London. And they were down South London, you know, in Rotherhithe, kind of by the river where the Cutty Sark was, in this really funky rehearsal room. You know, I schlepped down there, and it was really interesting because everybody was really chill. Like, nobody was really playing. And one by one, each guy, I think Pick Withers, the drummer, came up to me first and sort of started talking to me about stuff. And I was like, oh, he's a cool dude. I really like him. And then, you know, John Elsley, the bass player, came over and, oh, he's really cool too. I like him a lot. And then there was a keyboard player, Alan Clark, who was also kind of being auditioned at the time for the band. So me and Alan were coming in. And then at some point, Mark came over to me and he had a Walkman, which was this portable cassette player, which no one would understand in these days. But in those days, it was massive because for the first time, you could have fidelity to listen to in a portable fashion. Up to that point, I'd heard about it, but I'd never seen one in the flesh. So it was quite a big deal to see it. So Mark walked over and, you know, said hello and stuff. And then he handed me this Walkman and he said, just have a listen to this track. You know, don't worry about the changes. Just pick up the spirit of the thing. The track was Tunnel of Love. You better know those changes because there's a lot of them happening. So that was like the baptism of fire. So I listened to it a few times. And that was the first thing we played. And it was by this point, it was like getting, towards the end of the day. But, you know, in England, this was summer. This was August and you have really long days. So it doesn't get dark till later. And from that first crashing chord that comes on the downbeat, it was like, this is phenomenal. You know, you just knew right away. And by the time we got to the end of that song, like everybody was looking at each other thinking, wow, this is, the chemistry is really good. The sun was starting to go down over the river. And in those days, as the tide would pull out, you'd have guys working on their barges. So you'd hear the hammering of the barges there. And the sun starting to, bright red sun starting to set over the Thames. We did Salt to Swing. And at the end of that was like totally sold. You know, it was like, you totally fell in love and it was like, you know, you were committed, you know, meeting a woman that you just totally fell head over heels with and you couldn't see anything other than that woman. It was pretty spectacular. You know, we had like, I think a month or 6 weeks of rehearsals. And then next thing we were in Vancouver doing our first gig. Well, we did Lover of Gold. There was a live album, Alchemy. And then we did an EP called Twisting by the Pool. Love Over Gold, which we recorded in the power station, which I'm sure you remember. And, you know, it's sad because a lot of people don't know anything pre-Brothers in Arms. They only know Brothers in Arms. They don't know about, or Salt of the Swing, they know. In those days, what he would do, he'd turn up, we'd all have the lyric into us, printed out, and then he'd pick up an acoustic and he'd go, well, this is how this goes. And he would sort of like run it down a couple times. We're sitting there with our pencils and papers jotting any changes we could grab. And then if there was anything specific, like if there was a definite hook line, he would point out to either the keyboard player or me. Otherwise, he would, you know, listen to what you're trying to do. And, you know, he might try to shape what it is you're trying to do. He would understand what you're going for, but not quite getting into the direction that he would like it. So he would shape it. But you know what it's like when you're writing songs. You generally have a pretty good idea of where you're wanting to go with it. And considering, you know, his stuff was pretty fully formed, he was very generous at being open to suggestion and ideas. On stage, it was like a whole other thing too, because it was a band that was firing on all cylinders at all time, you know, because it was such a great live band. We did a 2.5-hour set and every gig we did a 2-hour sound check. It was taken very, very seriously. And in those days, it's really funny. I mean, your younger listeners won't understand this, but in those days you went on the road not to sell t-shirts, but to sell albums. When I joined the band, our American tour, we were just playing clubs, small clubs, really. By the time we finished that world tour 9 months later, we were playing stadiums because the Making Movies album just blew up. It skyrocketed. You know, there's nothing like being on stage on a starry night, packed to the gills, and doing Romeo and Juliet and seeing a sea of lighters waving from left to right. Quite emotional, actually. It all becomes like one, like all those people in the band, it all unifies into a single thing. It's not like just you standing on stage and a bunch of people out there. You're all like on the same wavelength. You're all in tune with each other. You're all feeling the same emotion. It's pretty powerful to go through that.
That's very true, because when you're in a band, it's not like you're just the only guy there. You're a unified force with the band and experiencing the same thing. Now he goes on to tell me how he got involved with composing, leaving Dire Straits behind.
Things changed, and, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a guitarist, and, you know, it just kind of felt it had gone as far as it needed to go for me, and I kind of was keen on getting into other things. I was keen on getting into scoring. You know, it just felt like the right time to go. While I still could, while I still could develop another career, which, you know, as you know, I scored a lot and I still do. I have 3 TV shows that are still running in the UK. I'm about to start the season 4 of The Syndicate in May. I'm going to start scoring that as the BBC. And, you know, scoring is awesome too, as you know, because that taps into a whole other side of your skill sets, because you're no longer writing for yourself. You're collaborating with the image on screen, and your sole job is to reach some emotional height, but it's to make that image on the screen pop to a higher degree than it's popping. So, you know, I've had some great experiences on the scoring front, and, you know, developed a huge catalog by doing it. Mark and I used to talk about it, you know, and he was keen on getting into scoring. And in those days, I kind of thought, well, yeah, you had to be like trained, you had to, you know, you have to study conducting, you have to be able to run an orchestra. And, you know, I was always really into film music, but I kind of didn't think it's something I could get into without doing a lot of studying. And, you know, Mark was talking about it. And then he did Local Hero, and he had the band sort of play on some of the tracks. So I was around, I was hanging around, played on some of the tracks and watching. And I thought, wow, maybe this is something I could do without having to, you know, go back to school and learning a bunch of things. That's what made it really interesting for me. That's like one of the things I really wanted to try. And so what happened is shortly after Dire Straits, I was asked, there was an Irish film that came out called Joyriders. They had a kind of traditional orchestral composer on it, and the filmmaker was super young. Aisling Walsh was a director, and she was like straight out of film school, very talented, and, you know, still working to this day, making really interesting movies. And, you know, she came to me and she was like, you know, we want something modern kind of thing. That gave me my in. I was introduced to a really interesting fella called Ray Williams. He was a music supervisor. And if you watch the Elton John movie, Rocket Man, he's sort of in the first third of it, because he was a young man working at Liberty Records, and he's the one who put Bernie Taupin and Elton John together. He is really great at pairing people together and finding talent and realizing which direction to channel it to. So I'd been introduced to Ray, and you know, I'd said to him, I was really interested in getting into scoring films and stuff. It was Ray that found this film. He called me up one day and says, I think we got a great project here that would work great for you. You know, he got me the gig. And then in those days, it was really complicated. It wasn't like you just go on a laptop and pull up Logic. In those days, you worked off a 3/4 U-matic, which was the videotape. You had to have a sync box to sync that to your tape machine, and then somehow you try to patch a little Atari computer in that for your MIDI. A, it was like incredibly expensive, and B, super complicated. So to get me through it, he put me together with a young Hans Zimmer, who was at that time based in London, and I think he was possibly still assisting Stanley Myers. I had a 2-hour crash course with Hans Zimmer on how to, you know, do all this stuff. At the end, and I still to this day, every time I see Hans, I remind him of this. He was going through all the stuff. You got to do this. You got to hit those marks. You got to like bring out the motion, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of this thing, he just looked at me and he said, but basically you just bullshit. You know, he wasn't far wrong on that, actually. So I did the score, and the film did well, and the score was well received, and you know, I was off and running. I kind of hung up all the rock and roll stuff because, you know, I'm a composer now. When you started, like, yeah, you got to play some guitar on this stuff. So I started getting back into like playing on tracks.
Yeah, I'm the blame. I brought him back into action to start playing on my tracks years ago because I thought, hey, man, why don't we do it? We come from the same background as far as being composers, so it was a great relationship. Now he goes on to tell me about his gear with Dire Straits.
You know, it's so funny that because people to this day still ask about that. Whatever was around, what the guitar that was closest to you'd pick up kind of thing. And in those days, you didn't really think too much about gear. Whereas now, I guess because of the internet, prior to the band, my two main things were a copper top, top boost AC30, which I bought in East London, early 1960s, maybe 63 or something, which I still have to this day, and it sounds phenomenal. I was a big Hi-Watt guy. I loved Hi-Watt. I never got into Marshall. Marshall always sounded like very natty and thin, whereas Hi-Watt was just massive and robust. And then guitar-wise, I didn't have that many, but I had my early 60s Strat, which I used in the band. I had a Rickenbacker, which Mark played. Gibson SG, which Mark played. It's a white three pickup, 60s. He played a lot of my guitars. I'm trying to remember what else he played. Gretsch, which is iconic, 1969. Gretsch Jet Firebird, and it's on the Twisting by the Pool EP. Mark plays it on a couple tracks, and I play it on a couple tracks. It's also all over Alchemy, the live video, which is one of my main guitars to this day. I still use it. Phenomenal guitar. It's got that Gretsch thing, but without really overstating the Gretsch thing. It's also the guitar that Malcolm Young played in AC/DC. We were using Music Man 2x12s, which is basically like their version of the Twin Reverbs, stock with Marshall 4x12s on stage for the first big tour. As I joined the band, Mark had just started getting into Schecters. It was a different Schecter. In those days, Schecter was more of a parts company because in the early 80s, Fender, sadly, due to mismanagement through CBS, their guitars were not really usable. So companies like Schecter came along who made great replica parts. Yeah. And Mark started using Schecter guitars. And the Schecter guitar was pretty much the sound of making movies. It kind of had more of a kind of, well, more ballsy for sure, but it also had this kind of mid-range honkiness to it. Mark, pretty early on, had a Schecter made for me, custom made. And it was, I don't know if you recall, on the Making Movies album, the two colors were red and blue. So his Schecters were red, and he had this blue one made, which were the colors of the Movies album. So it kind of branded the whole thing together. And that guitar I still have to this day, and he had the neck plate engraved, play it how, Mark, kind of thing. And beautiful bird's eye maple neck on it, and just a stunning guitar. So that became one of the main touring guitars, that and the 60s Strat. Later on, we shifted from the Music Man to Boogies with the same setup where you'd put the pump the Boogie through the Marshall 4x12. I got to say, neither of those amps blew up ever through all the touring. They both lasted the course, which is, you know, really what you're looking for when you're touring. Through the advent of eBay, we all went nuts. But, you know, I've got a closet full of vintage, this, tweed that, blackface this, you know, all this stuff. But the truth of the matter is I have one amp that I use for recording 90% of the time. And I maybe have like three or four guitars that I use 90% of the time. Most people use pedal boards. So, you know, by the time you're like going through some kind of booster and some kind of phaser and some kind of echo, it doesn't really matter what you're playing because it all sounds the same anyway. Well, on his last tour, which Mark just finished a little while ago, he wasn't using an amp. He was using the Kempler system. Mark is, he's all about sonics and tone. You know, I was listening, and of course his manager asked me, the first thing he asked me when he saw me afterwards was, well, what'd you think? What'd you think of the Kempler? To me, it just sounded a little harsher. You know, it didn't have that kind of warm. It sounded a little sterile. But anybody know? I mean, he was able to emulate every tone he had on the record perfectly. Everybody wants it to sound like a record. He didn't have to change amps. Brian and I had a long preamble before we got into this about the state of the music industry. you know, we came from a generation where music really meant a lot to people. And, you know, getting a vinyl album, waiting for its release, saving up to get it, getting it home and putting it on the turntable and being blown away are things of the past. I mean, that just doesn't exist anymore. So, I mean, that's my background. So, you know, I'm still like chasing the Holy Grail on tone. Nobody really cares. I mean, they probably wouldn't know a good tone from a bad tone, really. You know, my kids who play in bands, they like lo-fi. My daughter's like sponsored by Fender. She plays bass in that band. So she plays an old Mustang bass, which she turned me on to. I was recording her and I was so blown away by the sound that I actually went out and got a 60s Mustang bass. You know, I have a P bass here and it never gets used. I'm always on that Mustang. I don't know, something about short scale. On mine, I actually put a pair of old Precision pickups on it because I kind of thought that gave it a deeper tone. My son is very retro. He's very based in the 50s. He has an old, I think, early 60s semi-acoustic Guild 2 pickup. I think it's called a Starfire 2 or something. And I think he's a Fender artist as well. And Fender just gave him a really nice Telecaster with a Bixby on it. I still use the Adrenaline to this day. It came out around, I think it was the 90s. Very cool box. The downside of it, it's just way beyond complicated to use. Not only is it a really good amp simulator, but it has some incredible kind of modulation stuff. Kind of like a gating modulation type of thing. There's some really good stuff. So I kind of break out in sweat before I plug it in because, you know, it means trying to, you know what it's like. It's like, it's got so many menus, but like three buttons. So it means you're toggling all over the place to try to get to somewhere, which inevitably, after a while, you figure it out, but you instantly forget it once you've finished what you're doing. I know everybody's like pedal board crazy. You know, I like a bit of echo. I like a bit of reverb. There's a pedal, Earthquake Dispatch Master, warm analog sounding echo, good, nice reverb on that. One of my favorite pedals was Range Master, which is, you know, heard all over the 60s British iconic guitar sounds. And in fact, it was in the chain of Eric Clapton's Beano album between his guitar and his little Marshall combo. But there's a guy here, he's got a company called Veritone, and he's doing his take on that. You know, I'm big on fuzz. I love fuzz. I love the Super Reverb. I love it. One of my favorite amps, I have one, and I love it because it's super clean. You can have it super clean, but so punchy and powerful. But also, I use it for bass, for recording. In my studio, I use it for either like very clean stuff or bass.
Yeah, that is the holy grail of Fender amps, the Super Reverb. I got to try that trick he does using it for bass guitar. Now he tells me about all the projects he's involved with, as well as being involved with his kid's career in music, which I think is very cool.
In the last couple of years, I've had more and more people ask me to do stuff. I'm working with a producer called Mike Hedges, who was very iconic in the 80s. He did all the Cure stuff, Manic Street Preachers, Susie and the Banshee, ton of iconic bands. And he's producing a singer-songwriter called Janie Price. This has been a two-year project, but I'm one of the main songwriters on it. And his pitch to Janie was, how many songs you got? And she goes, well, I think I got about 20. His criteria for Janie was, you're going to write 100 songs, and we're going to whittle that down to 10. A lot of writing. I mean, I think Janie and I have written at least 50 songs, of which, you know, a good portion of those have been demoed. Getting hopefully towards the end of the album, I think they're starting to mix it finally. And I'm, you know, one of the main writers with Janie. We sort of like, we'll get in a room and we'll knock out, you know, three or four songs in a very quick amount of time. She was just here in LA. We were at the Village Recorders. Under an hour, we wrote three songs. We just knocked it out. So that's been a great experience. And then I also produced and co-wrote two tracks for an Irish singer called Lou Ann Parl, who has a new album out. She's based in Wicklow, Ireland. And then my daughter, who is 13, actually wanted to do a single. So she wrote a song. I helped put that together and produced her on that. It's called Out of My Mind by Evangeline Lindis. Funny enough, I'm working on a track writing with David Knopfler, who's doing a solo album. So we got this one track called This Isn't Kansas Anymore. And then also I'm doing, there's a company called West One out here, and they're a sync company, and we're going to do an acoustic guitar album, which due till the end of the year, but I'm going to hopefully start at some point on that when I get some time. And then just a couple of other things, just to recap, I'm going to have to pitch shamelessly my two kids who play in bands. My daughter Stas plays in a band called The Paranoids, and they have a new album called Carnage Bargain. And then my son Misha has his own band called Sad Girl. And they have an album out now called Water.
So you got to check out Hal's kids, man. They're the new generation of music. You know, I love Hal. He's just such a dear friend. And we've done so much music together. I feel like we're brothers from another mother. So here is Ricarda from Jazztopia. Thank you.
This is guitarist Hal Lindis from Dire Straits, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks WFIT, home of the Guitar Master series.
That's Distant Light, featuring Steve Morris and my good friend Hal Lindis, and myself, Brian Tarquin, from my new album, Vegas Blue. Before that was Hal Lindis with Irish Coast.